is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a very quick update in Paris, or actually a couple of cities around Paris, I guess. There has been a shootout that looks like the terrorists or the guys who shot up Charlie Hebdo are dead, it looks like. And one of somebody who is associated with them or in sympathy with them is also dead. And then we'll keep you up to date on all that. That being said, it is the first hour of our program on Friday, which means it's time for our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. What's on your mind today?
Well, as I think most of our listeners and viewers know, Congress reconvened this week. The Republicans are now in charge of both the House and the Senate. Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky is now the new majority leader, and they have a 54-46 majority. My role in the new Senate will be to be moving over from being chairman of the Senate Veterans Committee, a position I enjoyed very much, and it's a committee I'm going to stay on, to be ranking member, which is leader of the opposition on the Budget Committee, which is a fairly big deal. So we will see what happens as the new Congress gets moving. But I believe we have every reason to expect that the agenda of the Republican leadership in both the House and the Senate will not be a surprise to anybody who follows politics in America. And what the Republicans will be striving for in one way or another is to cut Social Security, and they've begun that process with a rule change in the House, to end Medicare as we know it by converting it into a voucher program, and then to move toward a balanced budget while at the same time they give huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people and the largest corporations, which means less revenue coming in. And if you're going to move to a balanced budget in 10 years, it means very draconian cuts in programs like Medicaid, nutrition, education, health care, and many, many other programs that middle-income and working-class people depend upon. So I think that's overall what the Republican agenda will be. And I will fight that every step of the way. In my view, at a time when we have massive wealth and income inequality, when real unemployment in this country is over 11%, counting those who have given up looking for work and are working part-time, when youth unemployment is 18%, when African-American youth unemployment is close to 30%, we have got to focus on the needs of working families. And the wealthiest people and the largest corporations surely do not need any more tax breaks. And one of the ways that the Republicans are going to try to bring about tax breaks for the rich and large corporations is through a process called dynamic scoring. What we have here in Congress is an effort on the part of the Congressional Budget Office to tell us how much a program costs, how much a tax cut costs. What they want to do is come up with what the first George Bush called voodoo economics. And that is to say, all right, we're going to give huge tax breaks to the rich and large corporations, but it really is not going to have a major impact on the deficit because magically these large tax breaks are going to translate into economic growth and more tax revenue coming in. So these tax breaks are not going to cost us anything. That is what we call voodoo economics. It is wrong. It is fraudulent. Historically, it has not worked the way the Republicans have said, and it's just a disguise, a way to obfuscate the impact of tax breaks for people who do not need that. What will also be coming, I believe, on the floor next week is this Keystone Pipeline. Let me say a word about that. The most important issue, I think, in terms of this debate is whether as a nation we want to move in a direction in opposition to what the entire scientific community in this country and around the world is telling us. What the scientific community almost unanimously is telling us is that climate change is real. Climate change is caused by carbon emissions and human activity. That climate change in terms of droughts, floods, extreme weather disturbances, rising sea levels is already causing devastating problems in our country and around the world. And that if we do not move aggressively to cut carbon and reverse climate change, these problems will only become more severe in the years to come. Now, that's what the scientists are telling us. And yet what we're debating right now and next week on the floor of the Senate is a bill to expand the production and transportation of some of the dirtiest oil on the face of the planet. That, to me, makes zero sense, no sense at all. And what I offered in the committee just yesterday and will offer on the floor of the Senate was a very simple amendment. And what the amendment said is that the scientific community is clear. How do members of the Senate feel about what scientists are telling us? Is climate change real? Should we transform our energy system or become more dependent on fossil fuels? When I brought that bill up on the Energy Committee, every Republican voted to table it, including one Democrat. So I am going to force the Republicans to tell the American people whether or not they agree with science, and we'll see how that plays out next week. Another issue of huge significance that does not get enough coverage by the media is the development of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a major, major trade agreement involving 12 countries around the world, not just Pacific Rim countries, but also the Mexico and Canada. I have had, and I know you and I have talked about this over the years, Tom, very, very strong concerns about our trade policies, and that includes NAFTA, CAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China. And the evidence that I see and the reports that I read tell us that each and every one of these trade agreements, net, if you add together the new jobs that have been created by export minus the jobs that have been lost by companies shutting down in America and moving to China, moving to Mexico, the end result is that all of these agreements have cost us jobs, adding them together, millions of decent-paying jobs. In the last 14 years alone in this country, we have seen the shutting down of over 60,000 factories, not all of that related to trade, but a lot of that related to trade. And what this TPP is about is, among many other things, forcing American workers to compete against people in Vietnam who are earning a minimum wage of 56 cents an hour. I don't think American workers should be forced to compete against people making 56 cents an hour. I don't think that American environmental laws passed in this country should be challenged in international tribunals. I think the American people have a right to make decisions for ourselves without having them overridden by foreign tribunals. I don't believe that poor people around the world should be forced to pay sky-high prices for medicine because of the power of the pharmaceutical industry in maintaining copyright provisions over the drugs that they produce and forcing poor people to pay more than they would if these drugs were made generic. And on the other point, what I have been fighting for and will introduce legislation to bring about is making college affordable. I think the president made an announcement yesterday, which is a good step forward. 2 years of free community college is a step in the right direction.
Amen. Senator Bernie Sanders with us for our national town hall meeting. Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with your questions for Senator Sanders right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, and it's a great news site to begin with. And welcome back. Senator, take some calls.
Let's do it.
Okay, James in Lockport, Illinois. You are and watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. You are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Oh, thank you, Tom. And I hope you guys had a great holiday season, both of you guys.
Thank you.
But, Senator Sanders, my big concern with Keystone, on Tuesday I called your office and I left a message with a staffer to and my concerns about our nation's wheat belt. Wednesday, you had brought that up in on the floor, and I was happy to hear that. Matter of fact, you were the only senator to bring up our food supply that I've heard, so I really appreciate that very much. But there's also other considerations. I noticed that in today's society, with the increase of terrorism around the world, I also see that that poses a big soft target in this country. What could be worse than devastating the water supply to 7 or 8 states? So I'm a big believer that we, if we're so sure of something, we should put our money where our mouth is. And maybe we can throw an amendment in there, which I'm sure would get tabled, about the people that vote yes on this will be responsible for the cleanup, and they will donate 50% of their total assets to help pay for cleanup. I think that would be real cool.
Well, James, let me just jump in and say you raise very important points. There are many, many elements involved in this discussion of the Keystone Pipeline, and one of them happens to be that this is very, very dirty oil. It is very heavy oil. And, in fact, there was a major spill in the Kalamazoo River in Michigan, which cost over $1 billion as part of the cleanup, and it's very, very difficult to clean up. And the last thing in the world that you want is to have a horrendous oil spill in an aquifer which is supplying water to millions of people. That's obviously a kind of a no-brainer. That is not what you want. And so that is a very important issue. But to me, the overriding issue is that when the scientific community is clear that climate change poses the great environmental crisis facing our planet, when scientists are telling us that we may be looking at an increase in the Earth's temperature by the end of this century from between 5 degrees Fahrenheit to 10 degrees Fahrenheit, which means that coastal communities all over this world may find themselves underwater as a result of rising sea levels, among many other concerns, that the Department of Defense and other national security people worry about what happens when people around the world see their land dry up or become flooded. They can't get the food they need, they can't get the water that they need, and there's going to be international conflict. So I think either we agree that climate change is a major crisis, that we have to be aggressive in leading the world in lowering carbon, or we don't. Or we don't. And if we do believe it's real, you don't go forward in the exploration and the transportation of the dirtiest oil on the earth.
Oh, we just have 4 seconds. Okay. I was going to ask a follow-up on that, but we'll get back to that. We'll be right back with Senator Bernie Sanders in our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman program with a guy I think of as America's Senator, Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont. Stick around. We'll be right back. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. It is our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And Paul in Woodinville, Washington, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom, and hello, Senator Sanders. I would like to talk about this outrageous attack by House Republicans on disabled people. This House rules points of order change initiated by Republican, Tea Party Republican, Tom Reed of New York, who apparently hates disabled people, and has introduced this points of order rules change to prevent the reallocation of funds to the Social Security Disability Fund. And if you could just, Senator, explain what's going on so people understand the ramifications and all such. And just briefly to tell you my own situation, I'm a person who is collecting SSDI. It's not a handout. It's an insurance policy that I paid into. I lost my eyesight to a disease that that causes blindness. It was I was diagnosed as a young child at the age of 5 years old, and I knew I was going to go blind, and I knew that I had to work The minimum is a work of 40 quarters or 10 years of work before you can collect SSDI. I have put in and paid my dues. I want my benefits, my insurance policy to pay off, and they're standing in the way. This is outrageous, and it seems to be their first order of business because it's what they introduced in the first day. It makes me think that disabled people have been in their sights. And they were just waiting for an opportunity to attack us, and that's what it is. It's an attack. I wonder if they want to save Social Security, why don't they start with the, what is it, 80 or 90 million retirees who are on Social Security, regular Social Security. Thank you.
No. Okay. Paul, thank you very much for telling us your story, and I agree with everything that you said. Disability benefits are not a handout. There are benefits to which the American people have paid into and are entitled to. And I agree with everything you said except the very, very last point. Let's not fall into that trap, which is what the Republicans want us to do, of playing off the elderly versus the disabled. And, in fact, that is what they want to do. What the Republican plan is to say, okay, if you want to make sure that the disability fund is solvent, okay, we'll go along with that. We'll help you do that. But you're going to have to cut Social Security benefits someplace else. In other words, they are using this, which is what their tactic will be in a lot of areas, as leverage for us to do something which I will not do. The way you solve, there are very easy ways to solve the problem of the disability fund, which, relatively speaking, is not a very difficult problem to solve in terms of the amount of money that is needed. You take money from the overall Social Security trust fund to help out. Republican rule that Paul is talking about wants to prevent us from doing that, and they're saying, okay, well, we will help out the disability fund if you start doing things like raising the retirement age for older people, or if you cut the cost of living adjustment through a so-called chain CPI. And we're going to fight that. And I think the American people do not believe that at a time we give huge tax breaks to the wealthy and large corporations, at a time when one out of four large corporations pays nothing in federal taxes, that the solution to deficit issues is to cut disability benefits. So we're going to fight that. It is, as I mentioned at the very beginning of this program, understand where the Republicans are coming from. This is their DNA. This is what they do. They want to cut Social Security. They're going to use the problem with the disability fund as a means to do that. Then they're going to go after Medicare. Then they're going to go after Medicaid. Then they're going to go after education. Then they're going to go after nutrition. And then on top of all of that, they're going to say that at a time when the rich are doing phenomenally well, they need more tax breaks. That is what their agenda is about. And Paul is right to highlight one aspect of that agenda, which we are very familiar with and going to be vigorous in opposing. Our job, Paul, is to put together millions and millions of people who say to the Republicans, sorry, you're not going to cut Social Security. You are not going to cut disability benefits. That ain't going to happen.
Stephen, in Deming, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for having me, gentlemen. I have a question for you in regard to TPP. Given that I am finding myself rapidly amongst tens of millions of Americans who are absolutely outraged at the fast track, and not to mention the dozens of other bills that the Republicans are presenting hoisting upon us that we are, including a rapidly growing number of Republicans, finding to be un-American, paradoxically happening in America, and that also, and given that such a large number of us, which was indicated by the last election, have been feeling.
Stephen, we just have 30 seconds. Can you make your point, and then Bernie will have to answer this on the other side of the break.
Yes, sir. Feeling hopeless about what we can do. Do you not agree, sir, gentlemen, that it's imperative for us to blitz President Obama, Nancy Pelosi, and our representatives now?
With regard to TPP. Okay. Senator?
The answer is absolutely. I agree with everything that Stephen said except one point. He said the Republicans, it's not just the Republicans. In this case, President Obama is a strong supporter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He and I disagree very strongly on that. Let's pick it up after the break.
Okay, great. We'll be right back. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. You can check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. You can check out his Facebook page. Just go over to Facebook and plug in Bernie Sanders, a very, very active site. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Sanders.senate.gov. And be sure to sign up for the Bernie Buzz. We'll be right back. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Michael in McDonough, Georgia, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Senator. Senator, I'm a Marine Corps veteran that was stationed at Camp Lejeune in the late 70s and 80s. I know you know what happened there about the contaminated water. Senator Sanders, I've been diagnosed with cancer twice. And because one of my cancers is not on the illness register, I've been denied benefits. And I was wondering, is there anything you could do to help us expand that illness list? There's a meeting at the CDC on Thursday here in Atlanta, which I will be attending. And I was wondering if there's anything you could do to help us.
Michael, the answer is yes. And legislation has been introduced. And I hope will be passed to make sure that all of the men and women who were impacted by this toxic water in Camp Lejeune get the health care and the benefits that they are entitled to. So that is something that I have supported and will continue to support.
Steve in Chicago, Illinois, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Bernie. I was calling about your bill that you are going to introduce next week about having Republicans answer to climate change science and the importance of it. It seems like the entire House and Senate are backed by big oil and don't care about the environment. How do we get them to act? And the number one way I think we can progress the environment is by introducing legalization of hemp. It's the number one food, fuel, plastic, medicine, and that's a simple solution. How do we get that bill passed?
Well, Steve, I'm not quite sure how we went from global warming to hemp. And I think in Vermont, our legislature, can't remember exactly what they have done, but have been sympathetic to the legalization of hemp, which is something that I am also not unsympathetic to. But I think in terms of climate change, as I said earlier, no sense repeating it, it is an embarrassment, I think, to the American people that we have the dominant party on Capitol Hill right now, the party that controls the House and the Senate, not standing up and saying, yeah, we agree with the overwhelming majority of scientists in America around the world that climate change is real, it is causing devastating problems, it is caused by human activity, and we have to transform our energy system. That is not a really, in most parts of this world, that is not a controversial statement. And yet it is here with the Republican Party in Washington. And I've got to do my best, along with other members, to say, hey, guys, either you're going to be with science or you're against science. And if you're going to be against science, we're going to make sure the American people know that.
Scott in Scottsdale, Arizona. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thanks, Tom. Senator, I think you guys are great. You give such great information. I have a question about the drop in gas prices. I believe I've heard on your program that this is somehow linked to getting the bank speculators out of it. And I'd like to be able to speak intelligently as to what changes in the law, whether it was Glass-Steagall or Dodd-Frank, caused this. Can you help with that?
I'll let Tom, the issue of why gas prices have dropped so precipitously is an issue that I am not sure that most people really, there are a lot of thoughts about that out there. I am not quite sure what the real cause is. So I don't want to speculate on that. I think what Scott is talking about is what we know to be a fact, and what has concerned me for a long time is that the energy futures market is not controlled by what we call end users, i.e. people who actually use the product, airlines, trucking companies, etc. It has been very significantly controlled by Wall Street, Morgan Stanley, among others, who have owned a significant part of the oil on the oil futures market. But there are different theories out there as to why oil prices have gone down, what the role of Saudi Arabia, the geopolitical part of this process, is it an attack on Russia, is it an attack on Iran? It is hard to say. Tom, if you want to jump in there, I don't want to make a statement about something that I'm not yet
sure
100% clear about. Your thoughts on that?
The one thing that I had noticed that I shared with our audience, in fact, a listener pointed out to me, was that Dodd-Frank required tighten up the rules on commodity trading. And in March, in the New York Times, there was a series of articles over about a week-long period about how bank after bank, big bank after big bank in New York City was selling off their trading divisions and, in many cases, disposing of their futures contracts. And these were typically six-month contracts. And surprise, surprise, 6 months after that happened, the price of oil started dropping. Now, whether that's a correlation or not, I don't honestly know, but I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, so and I agree. It is interesting. It is a complicated issue, and I'm not sure that we do fully understand why oil prices have dropped.
If it does indicate, though, that the banksters are keeping the price high, it means that they've been scamming us for years.
Well, but that we do know.
Yeah,
I mean, when you have – I mean, most people would think that the energy or the oil futures market would be controlled by people who actually use the product. But that certainly has not been the case.
Yeah.
It has been controlled by speculators who, of course, speculate in order to make a profit.
Yep.
And that's clear.
Donald in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, hi. How do you do, Senator Sanders? I got a question. Because of the fact that all this business about Social Security being, you know, that they might go ahead and make changes if it's going to affect all of us, it doesn't seem like the Democratic Party is on top of it. They're just too silent. Now, I have all the money that we send to them now, because they're always asking for money, why don't they take that money and start putting commercials out and start attacking them now?
Okay.
They don't even have to mention the fact that they could say, you know, it's for concerned citizens to save Social Security and Medicare, something like that. And
right. Name. Donald, let's let Bernie answer the question, please.
All right. Well, Donald, what I will tell you, Donald, is a number of us are not going to be silent on this issue. And sometimes, I know very often, you know, Tom, people will call up and they say, well, you're silent, you're not speaking out on the issue. Sometimes we are speaking out on the issue, but it doesn't necessarily translate into a front page story in the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune. Donald, go to my website, go to my Facebook, and you will see us speaking out very forcefully, not only in opposition to what the Republicans are planning, not only in terms of the need to protect Social Security, but in fact the need to expand Social Security benefits. And my view is, and I have introduced legislation and will be on other legislation, to do away with the current cap on taxable income going into the Social Security Trust Fund, which is now at about $118,000. If you lift that cap and start at $250,000, we can not only extend the life of Social Security beyond the next 19 years where it is solvent, but we can also raise enough revenue to expand Social Security benefits, which is exactly what we should do. There are a whole lot of seniors out there who are trying to survive on $12,000, $13,000, $14,000 a year, buy the medicine they need, the food they need, the heating that they need, and they can't do it. So we're going to fight. Some of us have been vocal on it. You may not have heard it yet, Donald, but I will do my best, and I know there are other people in Congress who will do their best to take this fight to the Republicans and to rally millions of Americans to say loudly and clearly that at a time when so many people are struggling, you are not going to cut Social Security. In fact, we're going to expand Social Security.
Jerry in Baraga, Michigan. A quick question, please, Jerry.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd like to get to Senator Sanders' thoughts on the two largest elephants in the room that I consider, first being the trillion-dollar-a-year tax haven evasion industry going on around the globe. And then secondly, Senator, is it time to nationalize the privately owned Federal Reserve? Thank you.
What Jerry is talking about is the fact that we are losing as a nation huge amounts of revenue because large and very profitable corporations are stashing their money in tax havens like the Cayman Islands and in Bermuda and Luxembourg, etc. Just in front of me, Tom, I have some information that Jerry would be interested in, and that is just a few examples. Over the past 6 years, General Electric, one of our large corporations, made nearly $34 billion in profits in the United States. Meanwhile, over that six-year period, not only did they pay nothing in taxes because, as Jerry indicated, they stashed their money in tax havens, but they actually got a rebate from the IRS for some $3 billion. In 2013, Boeing paid zero in federal income taxes after making and actually received $199 million tax refund from the IRS after making $6 billion in profits. And the list goes on and on. Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase. Point being, as Jerry, I think, indicates, you have large, profitable corporations stashing their money abroad in tax havens, not paying anything in federal income taxes, sometimes getting rebates. That is clearly unacceptable. We're going to work on that.
We'll be back with more of your questions for Senator Bernie Sanders right after this. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And for everything Bernie, check out sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for his newsletter. You can go over to his Facebook page on Facebook. It's easily found. His Twitter feed. It's all great stuff. And welcome back, Dave, in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders. I called 6 or 7 weeks ago on a topic, but I have a specific question this week. My topic was adding the following friendly amendment to the satellite TV laws. It goes like this. All cable and satellite TV stations must carry C-SPAN 1, 2, and 3 in consecutive order. So my specific question is, will you talk to the incoming Republican chairman of the Judiciary and Commerce Committee and the ranking members, and then, because it's got to pass the House and the Senate, the person who took Howard Cobell's place in his committee and the ranking Democrat. I represent about 90 million C-SPAN families, but they don't know they have a chance to talk to you who could have an effect on this. So I would appreciate an affirmative response.
Well, Dave, I don't know who I'm going to be talking to, but this is a very important issue, and I will work on it. And I'll tell you why, Dave. We just had an election, a midterm election, a couple of months ago. 63% of the American people did not vote. We have situations where people do not know, majorities of people do not know which party controls the House or the Senate. They don't know what goes on in Washington. They don't know very much about the budget. We are doing a bad job in our schools all over this country in terms of having young people understand what we used to call civics, what government does, what the Constitution is about. And I think that C-SPAN does do a very, very good job in allowing people to hear what's going on here in Washington, in the House, in the Senate, and from various organizations. And I do get concerned that you have C-SPAN 2 on channel, you know, 387 in some networks. So, Dave, I think your point is a very good point, and I think we should make sure that the American people have an opportunity when they sit in front of the TV set to learn about and listen to what goes on here in Washington. And C-SPAN does a good job, and we should make that more accessible to people.
Bill in East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. You've got about a minute and a half, maybe 2 minutes to the break, Bill.
Thank you. I want to just say that I hold you both in very high regard, and I thank you for taking my call. And I just want to make a quick comment. I just believe that we, the progressives and the oppositions to the Transatlantic Pacific Partnership, should call it TRAP. Stop letting them call it TPP. Call it TRAPP. Because that's what, you know, if Fox News was against it, they'd be calling it TRAP. And we, progressives don't really do enough stuff like that. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks for your thought, Bill. I have made it very clear, and a number of other senators and members of the House have made it very clear, that for two fundamental reasons, we're going to be opposed to whatever you want to call it, but it's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. And that is, number one, in terms of what we know about the content, it is a continuation of past disastrous trade policies. And number two, there has been very little transparency, so we don't know what is in the agreement. People should not be voting on something that they have not read.
Be right back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls, our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Bob in Crystal Lake, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Bob, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that stop negotiating from a point of weakness as far as Social Security. You want to put a cap on it, don't. Work back to your cap. That's all. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Bob's suggesting doing away with the cap, Senator.
Yeah, well, that's what we're going to do. I think, though, we sought at about $250,000, and if we do that, we will raise a significant sum of money, which will allow us to extend the life of Social Security, which is now fully solvent for the next 19 years. And also allow us to increase benefits. But here's what we have. We have a political situation where the vast majority of the people, whether they are progressive, moderate, or conservative, understand how important Social Security is to their lives and the lives of millions of elderly people and disabled people. They understand that. And you got a Republican Party who dislikes government, does not believe that government should be in the business are providing retirement benefits, and they want to either cut benefits or eventually privatize the system. Very few people agree with them. And what our job is, as Bob indicates, is not to negotiate from weakness. We have the vast majority of the people on our side. But our job is to bring those people together to say to any senator, any member of the House, you cut Social Security, you are going to pay a political price for that. That's what our job is.
Vince in Pomeroy, Iowa. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, the Constitution gives Congress the right to limit the Supreme Court's actions. When is Congress going to start doing its job? Thank you.
Well, not quite so simple, Vince. In my view, in terms of the worst decision that has come out of a bad Supreme Court in recent years, which is Citizens United, we are working hard for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, because many of us believe that free speech does not mean that billionaires can buy elections and spend unlimited sums of money. So that is one area where we're going to try to undo a terrible, terrible Supreme Court decision.
Kenyatta in Redlands, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Senator Sanders, I wanted to say a couple of quick things to you. I know that you're an independent, and I applaud that, and I want you to run in 2016. I know that you've not really made a decision there, and you've kind of not really been enthusiastic about it, but there are a lot of people out here, and I'm one of them, that will do whatever we can to see you in office. Now, having said that, here's my question, Senator. And we had a Reagan-Bush administration for Bush's vice president for 8 years. Then we had a Bush administration that would have been the former vice president for 4 years. Then we had Bush W for 8 years. Then we had Bill Clinton for 8 years. Then we've had Obama, at his second term, but we did have a Clinton in the White House as Secretary of State, who is now going to be running apparently in 2016 by all appearances. And then we're looking at another Bush, Clinton election possibly in 2016. As a country that applauds itself on, democracy and anyone being able to be involved in public service, doesn't this look a little strange?
I was speaking to some people yesterday, Kenyatta, and that's the point that I made. This is not an attack on Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush, but it does seem a little bit weird that in a nation which is supposed to be a vigorous democracy, where we tell our sons and daughters that anybody can grow up to be president of the United States, that it seems to be that those people who have family connections of one kind or another seem to be the people we look to or are in a position to become president of the United States. And I think what that speaks to is the unfortunate state of American democracy, where for the average person who does not have a lot of money, who does not come from a family which has a lot of name recognition, which is 99.9% of the American people, they're looking out there and they're saying, nobody knows my family's name. I don't have access to huge sums of money. Why in a million years would I run for office, or how can I get elected? And that is a real problem. I mean, what democracy is supposed to be is a wanting and seeing right people who are concerned about public service, regardless of their political views, jumping in with pride and saying, I have ideas. I want to be serving the public. I want to run for office. And what you're seeing now is so many people saying, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it because I can't raise tens and tens of millions of dollars. I'm not going to do it because I don't want to take on the Koch brothers and get my character destroyed or my name destroyed. I'm not going to do it. And maybe those people around who will do it are names that, people in their states or the country know and start with that advantage. So I think it speaks to the weak state of American democracy and the need for us to create a political revolution where once again young people, bright people, jump into politics with pride, and we support their efforts.
Senator, we have about 45 seconds before the end of the hour.
Well, I think we raised a lot of issues today. I mean, the last question deals with the state of American democracy, the demoralization of the American people, whether or not we are still a nation where we can honestly tell our kids and grandchildren that even if you don't have a lot of money, even if you're not from a famous family, you can become a senator, you can become a governor, you can become president of the United States. Are we honest in suggesting that to our kids and grandchildren, or are those days gone? We heard a lot of discussion today about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, in my view, a disastrous trade agreement, which will lead to the loss of more jobs in this country, and clearly people are concerned about coming attacks on Social Security, which we have got to defeat back. So I thought it was a very good program today, Tom.
Thank you so much, Senator, for being with us today. Great having you on. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Bernie Sanders, be sure to check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. At the bottom of the hour, the Secretary of Labor, Tom Perez, is going to be with us. We'll get an update on the jobs numbers that were released by the U.S. government today. And it's always interesting to talk to a fellow who sits in the cabinet, you know, with the president on a regular basis, who is a member of the cabinet, of the president's cabinet. So we will get to that, but right now it's Friday. Anything goes Friday, whatever you'd like to talk about. Mark in DeKalb, Illinois. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I was just curious about what your opinion would be. In Australia, they have mandatory voting for their citizens. How you would feel about bringing something like that here to the United States and what any hurdles that might have to be overcome to bring that here, obviously. It'd be great to overcome our voter turnout problem and lessen the power of money in our democracy.
Yeah. I believe that in Australia, the prod that they use to get people to vote is their tax law. If you don't vote, then you are fined, and the agency that does that is their equivalent of our IRS, and which is not unlike the way that we provided penalties for Obamacare. You know, if you don't buy any health insurance at all, you get hit with, I think it's $95 a year that you have to pay to the IRS, or something like that. And you know, I think it would be a great idea. I don't think that it could happen, though, because this idea of taxing people or fining people for not engaging in behavior is something that the Supreme Court has taken up in the past. Obamacare might be setting a precedent. On the other hand, that might get blown up. But I think that anything that we can do to encourage voting is a good thing. One of the things that I noticed, I spent a fair amount of time in Australia back in the 90s, and before I started doing this radio program, one of the things that I found most interesting was that because pretty much everybody votes, they got about a 98% compliance rate, everybody pays attention to politics because they know that they're going to have to offer their opinion. And so, you know, I think some form of mandatory voting or an incentive to vote or a disincentive not to vote would be a good idea. It's just the devil's going to be in the details. Mark, thanks for the call and the question. Ed in Miami. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hello, Tom. I want to thank you for the work that you do on behalf of the people.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking my call, and I want to wish you a happy and prosperous New Year.
Thank you. You too, Ed.
There's been a long-standing rumor that back in the 70s, either one of the secretaries or administrators out of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs marketed surety bonds in the name of some Vietnam veterans. And as a result, the Vietnam vet was mostly disenfranchised when he came back from Southeast Asia due to the effect of stigmatization and all of that. So I was wondering if you – I remember back in the 70s, T. Boone Pickens mentioned briefly about these bonds that were – as he called them junk bonds, but that were sold on the open market. And I was wondering if you had heard anything about that, purchasing.
I have, Ed, and it's a variation on the what's called dead peasant insurance policies that companies like Walmart used to do. I'm guessing that they probably still do. fast food outfits and places like that, where increasingly they're hiring people who are not teenagers, and you're paying them very little, and they take out a life insurance policy on them, and if the person dies, then all the money goes to the company, and the family, in most cases, doesn't even know that there's a life insurance policy on their person. The theory with regard to this thing back in the post-Vietnam era was that somebody in the VA was basically buying, you know, a bond is sort of like an insurance policy. To the best of my knowledge, it's never been demonstrated to be true. It's the dead peasant insurance policies that corporations in the United States are taking out on their employees. That's definitely true. That is happening. But I'm pretty sure that if anybody in the VA had ever done anything like that, that it would have been politicized. It would have been that person or those people would have been called out and fired, and it would have been a huge scandal. So if they did, they buried it really deep. But I doubt that it happened, frankly, Ed. Does that help?
All right. Thank you. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is whether or not you think that the doing away with Dodd-Frank, that portion which they seem to have gotten the whole thing just – I mean,
yeah, it was a terrible thing. I mean, you know, it's or the efforts now to do away with Dodd-Frank is a misguided effort. Dodd-Frank is doing a lot of good things for this country. It's nowhere near as strong as what we need to do, which is basically roll back Phil Graham's Gramm-Leach-Bliley bill, which blew up Glass-Steagall, and then you wouldn't need Dodd-Frank, or at least some of Dodd-Frank. But yeah, I'm with you on that. Ed, thanks for the call. Jack in Gainesville, Florida. Hey, Jack, what's up?
What I'm calling about is the end of Racial Profiling Act, which introduced in Congress 2001, 2004, 2005, 2009, 2010, 2012, and 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And it has not been approved by either a Democratic Congress or Republican Congress, or a Democratic Congress which had President Obama in office. And as a black American here, I'm concerned about this act that would go a long way in reducing racial profiling throughout the nation. Have you heard of this act?
I have not, frankly. I'm sorry, Jack. I should have. My assumption would be that if it's anti-racial profiling at the federal level, that it would only apply to things like the FBI, to federal police agencies?
No, sir. No, sir.
Okay, tell me about it.
It also gives... it also covers state and local jurisdiction,
huh,
and gives the federal government and individual the right to issue an injunction against those particular people who do racial profiling.
Right.
And the Attorney General, he tried to implement a little bit of it. But what I'm saying is this. If racial profiling has been going on in these United States all these years, and as a black person who knows that has been a victim and know people who have been a victim and know that it's still continuous going on.
Sure. Still
is. And you had a black president, and you had, which was at one point, they were in control of everything, and nobody seemed to know anything about this act. I talked to you, the third radio personnel I've talked to, and you know nothing about it.
Yeah.
And somewhere down the line, it should have been assimilated and throughout the U.S. country, so people know what was going on in Congress, if those particular people in the Democratic Party really wanted to do something about racial profiling.
Yeah, yeah. I don't disagree with you, Jack. I'm sorry that I'm not at all familiar with this or the details of it. What I do know is that racism in this country runs really, really deep, particularly in the South. But I think it's equally bad in the North. It just takes a different form and or shows up in a slightly different way. I've lived in Atlanta. I've lived in northern states, Michigan, New Hampshire, Vermont, Oregon. We've got largely a lily white Congress. You know, you've got one black member of the Republican Party in Congress, as far as I know. And you know, the black caucus in the House is relatively small compared to the rest of Congress, and there's a lot of white members of Congress in southern states that just in particular who I'm sure would not go near something like this. It's it's a tragic statement about the nature of our legislative body. But I wouldn't hold my breath for anything like this. Although I agree with you, it's something that should be pushed if it's the way you describe it. I'm going to see what I can learn about it, Jack, and maybe we'll do a program on it soon. Thank you for the call, and thanks for the heads up. I really appreciate it. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. It's Friday. Anything goes Friday. You can pick the topic. I got a few things to rant about as we continue through the program. And welcome back. Cliff watching Free Speech TV in Canyon Country, California. Hey, Cliff, what's on your mind?
Good afternoon, Tom. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you, Cliff.
I want to talk about the EPA. Now, I acknowledge they've done some great things since their inception, some very necessary things. However, in the recent past, there's been some disturbing behavior, and I feel that this is just another government agency corrupted by the industries it's supposed to regulate. For example, Christy Todd Whitman, with pressure from Rudy Giuliani, of course, for Wall Street, but she told everyone that New York was, ground zero was safe. Couple days after 9/11, and then hundreds, maybe thousands of first responders got very ill and several died. Lisa Jackson allowing BP to pour who knows how many millions of gallons of Corexit into the Gulf of Mexico just to get rid of the oil, and we know that it just sunk to the bottom, but their point was out of sight, out of mind, because they didn't want that sheen all over the news. And more recently in Dimmock, I think it's Dimmock, Pennsylvania, the EPA was testing the drinking water over there, and they abruptly stopped testing, leaving the residents without conclusions, but they know their water was contaminated by the fracking going on nearby. And lastly, the use of neonicotinoids, the pesticides that's killing the bees,
right.
The EPA approved, I think it's called sulfoxaflor, it's a toxic pesticide, and, it's the science is pretty conclusive that that's one of the reasons the bees are dying off. So it's outrageous to me that this agency is doing that. And now we have the Republicans that want to cut funding or eliminate the EPA so the Koch brothers can pollute with impunity. I mean, we're destroying the planet at an alarming rate, and we really need the EPA to do their job and not bow down to these industries. What do you think?
I do not disagree with you, Cliff. The EPA, every federal agency right now is suffering from a certain amount of regulatory capture. And great case in point is, look at the all the drama going on over at the FCC about net neutrality. And I believe that actually, if the FCC, Tom Wheeler, who is a former telecommunications lobbyist, runs the FCC, and he's now come out and suggested that they may classify the internet as a common carrier under Title II, which indicates that if enough people make enough noise, because the FCC's gotten over 4 million, I believe, signatures now saying we want net neutrality, that a regulatory agency can actually respond to the people, even though Tom Wheeler's not elected by the people, he's appointed by the president. And so the same thing with the EPA. If enough Americans are truly, truly want the EPA to more aggressively protect us and our environment, which is its portfolio, then we need to be speaking out, and this might be a good touchstone, a good pivot point, a good I'm missing the word, but mechanism for people to organize around, as they did with net neutrality, for organizations that are concerned about the environment to organize around. But I don't know which agencies or which organizations are doing that. But Cliff, and the other point, thank you, Cliff, for the call. The other point about regulatory capture is that it's been made possible by the Supreme Court asserting that money is the same thing as political speech and therefore protected under the First Amendment. And the corporations are the same thing as humans and therefore protected under the 14th Amendment. And these twin doctrines have allowed these corporations to basically own people inside these regulatory agencies. Hey, Tom Hartman here. The organic wine company, EcoWine.com, is unique in that they stock a wide variety of handcrafted organic wines from their very own small family-owned vineyards in France. Véronique's 75-year-old grandfather, Pierre Fabre, a professor of medicine, converted the family farm, La Bosquette, to organic wine. And now Véronique Raskin's mission is to share her passion for high-quality organic wine with those who enjoy wine. Drinking organic wine reduces your exposure to harmful chemicals, reduces the impact of pesticide use on the people who grow the grapes, reduces the threat to groundwater contamination, and helps to promote biodiversity. More information at ecowine.com. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Robert driving through Memphis, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. This is a rant that I've had for since the Ferguson shooting. And I'm a retired police officer. I've been through more training than most police officers and been in a couple shootings myself, been shot at, ambushed a couple times during my career.
Ouch.
And so what I've noticed is that what's led to the police deaths in Ferguson, New York, and Cleveland is atrocious police patrol tactics. And in my training, had proper tactics been used, it wouldn't guarantee that you wouldn't have to use deadly force, but it probably would have avoided it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to get this message out, not only to the people, but to the other police officers, to get them to acknowledge that, you know, it's the training that we need to improve.
Hmm. I don't disagree with you.
Argument at all?
No, I don't disagree with you at all. And I've had a brush with police training, having been through the Georgia Police Academy back in '96 when they opened it up to civilians for training for security for the Olympics. And I would add to that we need to more carefully screen who gets to become a police officer, and we need to pay them better so that we can justify that screening. And so there's a larger pool of potential applicants, and you know, make it a profession like it is in Northern Europe, where, well, arguably it is. I mean, people get into it and into being a police officer, stay for 20, 30 years, get a pension and retire. It should be in Denmark, for example, or Finland, or at most of the Scandinavian countries, police officers make about what doctors make, and they're held to very, wow, very high standards. So is that making sense?
Yeah. And that would help. That's a real long-term goal, I suppose. There was 1,000 applicants just for my job alone when I got hired. And they screened that many people before they got to me and actually hired me.
Yeah.
So I think they do a lot of screening. But what happens is you change as you grow into your badge. And what happens, I think what they've done since 9/11 is that they're training officers when they can shoot, but not when they should shoot, because you need to utilize more tactics. You need to work smarter, not harder.
Right.
And trying to avoid that. Yeah. Trying to avoid that situation altogether. You know, you could break down each one of them to show, I don't know can you see that as a layman?
Yeah.
Where the officers made mistakes.
Yeah.
The way Wilson backed up to the strong-armed suspect Brown and presented his door, you know, rather than using his car as a shield in case Brown was armed. But he backed up and opened up his door and stepped out right to where, or tried to step out right to where Brown was. And that's horrible tactics.
Right.
The second prong to that is the grand jury process.
Yeah.
Clearly that's been bastardized and they don't.
That needs to be deleted altogether. We need to have, and one state has already done that. I think it's Wisconsin. In fact, I'm sure it's Wisconsin. It was the result of a family whose son was killed by the police about 10 years ago, and they lobbied like crazy for years to get this law passed that there was an independent police review board that was independent of the police department and the prosecutor's office that would look at police shootings, and I think we need that all across the country too. Robert, thank you for the call, and thanks for the common sense perspective. It's brilliant. Lee in Los Angeles. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you, my friend?
I am well. How are you, Lee?
I'm doing good, fellow ADDer. I will read your books when you get around
okay,
to it.
When you get around to it. So what's up?
The TPP thingy. Why is Obama, this is what I've read, why has the administration been in talks for 5 years for this NAFTA-like, and you've probably talked about this, international trade conglomeration when we need manufacturing here? I don't get it. I think this is a really bad indicator of judgment, and I wanted your opinion on it because I know Bernie Sanders wrote a really, I don't want to use the word angry, pointed letter talking about the secrecy and inaccessibility to the text, et cetera. And it just looks like it's being rushed through, and it just defies me why they would go in this direction. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Lee. I don't know what's in President Obama's heart or mind with regard to this. Clearly, if you take his words at face value, he believes that free trade agreements, in quotes, inure some benefit to the United States. I disagree. I strongly disagree. And, you know, a lot of other people strongly disagree, too. Maybe he knows something I don't. I don't think so. I mean, you know, if you look at the history of NAFTA and CAFTA, I don't think SHAFTA is going to be any different in terms of, you know, it's just going to further erode the income of the American worker. We have offshored so much of our manufacturing, as Bernie pointed out in the last hour. 60,000 factories have gone away just since 2000. And I'm, you know, this really started in a big way in 96 with NAFTA and GATT and the WTO. But it started in a smaller way back in the 80s during the Reagan administration. In fact, you could argue that it was Richard Nixon who was first calling for it when he went to China on behalf of Pepsi Cola. So I honestly don't know what the, you know, why the administration is pushing this other than, well, I don't know. I don't want to speculate about their motives. We'll be back. Anything Goes Friday. Labor Secretary Tom Perez is going to be with us briefly at the bottom of the hour, right after the bottom of the hour. And then we'll be picking up your calls as we continue through the day.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And Anything Goes Friday. Also, check out our live free chat room. You can drop in over at TomHartman.com. It's a hoot. Tom Hartman here with you, and Secretary of Labor Tom Perez is with us. The United States Department of Labor, DOL.gov, is the website. Secretary Perez, welcome back to the program.
Tom, it's great to be with you and with all your listeners. Happy New Year.
Thank you so much, and Happy New Year to you too, sir. So tell us about the numbers that your department released today.
Well, today was numbers day, as you correctly point out, and what we saw last month was another very solid month of job growth, over a quarter million jobs. And when you add in some of the adjustments from the two preceding months, actually over 300,000. And when you look at 2014 as a whole, 3 million jobs added, the best year since 1999. We saw the largest decline in the unemployment rate since 1984. We are in November of 2013, we were somewhere around 7%. Now we're at 5.6%. That's not what some of our pundits predicted, and the primary reason for the remarkable decline in the unemployment rate is that more unemployed people got jobs, and the majority of those who got jobs were long-term unemployed. So this is all good news, and the growth was very broad-based last year. Construction did well, manufacturing did well. The average person on an assembly line is working 42 hours a week. The auto industry is back. I was with the president Wednesday in Detroit. A gallon of gas was $3.33 a year ago. When I was driving to the event with the president, I saw a gas station. It was $1.67.
Wow!
In Detroit, my eyes popped. And so we've got a tailwind here. But at the same time, there's undeniable unfinished business because there's still too many people on the sidelines who want to get back in the job market, and there are way too many people who haven't had a raise in years. Because, or a meaningful raise, because wages just haven't kept pace with the increases we've seen in productivity. And so Americans deserve a raise. And
yeah.
I wake up every day asking myself the question, and I know the president does the same, what can we do to help workers get a meaningful raise? What can we help? What can we do every day to build pipelines to the middle class, to build ladders of opportunity? The president today announced, a very bold and important initiative to make a community college accessible free of charge to low-income people who are willing to work hard and upskill. Those are the types of things. The best way to increase real wages over time in terms of the long term, one of the best ways is to make sure people have the education to thrive and succeed. That's how my parents always taught me, education's the great equalizer. And there's an undeniable education dividend. The more education you have, the better the chances there are of your punching that ticket to the middle class. And you don't need a four-year degree to punch your ticket to the middle class. There are really good pathways. And employers tell me all the time, I want to grow my business. I'm bullish about the future of my company here in America. And what I want is to make sure we have that skilled workforce to compete. And that's what the president's talking about today. So we're going to keep fighting to increase the minimum wage. We're going to fight to expand the construction and the construction infrastructure, but also our human capital infrastructure. We're going to invest in that as well.
I'm old enough to remember what life was like in the United States before Reaganomics, before 1980. And as Elizabeth Warren pointed out day before yesterday, up until 1980, you know, throughout the era from the 30s until Reaganomics, the 90%, the bottom 90% got 70% of all the new income that came in pretty much over each one of those five decades. And then it just froze when Ronald Reagan declared war on working people, starting with firing Patco and then throughout his administration. And we've been in this and Reaganomics world for 33 years now. She said that 100% of all income gains have gone to the top 10%. The bottom 90% has been zero. We used to believe in this country that even if you didn't have a college education, if you worked hard, there was an inherent dignity to work and everybody should be allowed to get into the middle class, even if they're just working at a fast food place. How do we do that? How do we get back to that? How do we roll back this? And do you even think it has to do with Reaganomics, or is it just something else? Is it just?
Well, I mean, you look at the data, and historically there was a very, very strong linkage and an appropriate linkage between productivity and wage growth. As our nation became more productive, businesses were more prosperous, and that prosperity was shared with workers. And then you look starting in the You look at productivity increases since the late 70s and roughly 1980, and you see productivity has increased over 90%. And during the same period, real wage growth has increased something like 2 or 3%. And so that basic covenant of if we have tough times, we have shared sacrifice, and when we have good times, we have shared prosperity, that basic covenant withered. And as a result, we're in this situation where today, you know, last year, there were something like 50 record highs on Wall Street. And that's good for America. That's, you know, if you have a 401k, that's a good thing. But all too many people, we want these record highs and the record profits to translate into shared prosperity.
Right.
That's the key. This last year was the best year for job growth since 1999. The difference between where we are now and where we were in 99 is that the rising tide lifted more boats in 99, and we've still got way too many boats that are taken in water. And that is why we're focused at the Department of Labor on what we can do with our regulatory authority, for instance, to raise wages. We're focused on the minimum wage, and we helped states across this country and local governments increase the minimum wage, and it's great that 20 states saw increases that helped about 7 million people, but you shouldn't have to win the geographic lottery to get a raise. We should be doing it at the federal level. That's why we're fighting like heck for, you know, transportation bill and immigration reform. Those will lift wages. Those will create good jobs. And I think today's announcement from the president about investing in education, that's a long-term investment that will always pay rewards.
Yeah.
Because, again, my parents always taught me, and I suspect you're in the same boat, education is the great equalizer, and we need to do this because people, so many workers helped bake this cake of prosperity, but they're not sharing in that prosperity, and that's not who we are as a nation. So many people are wondering if the middle class is out of reach. I say, hell no. And that's why we're fighting every day to make sure that there are ladders of opportunity for everybody.
When typically when there's a union in a town or in a community or in a labor market, the union wage sets the floor for all wages. So for every union job that makes a certain amount, there's one non-union job that makes about the same amount. And when Reagan came into office, almost a third of our workforce was unionized. Now it's down in the private sector. It's down to around 8%. So it used to be, about 60% of our workers had the equivalent of a good union wage. Now it's 16%. What can the Department of Labor do, if anything, about that?
Sure. I believe worker voice is a key component to ensuring that we have shared prosperity. There's no doubt about it. If you are a union worker, your median weekly income is $200 more than a non-union worker. And that doesn't include benefits, by the way.
Right.
We went with the president. I was with him this week in Detroit at the Ford Motor Company. The Ford Motor Company and the challenges they confronted in the Great Recession and the resurgence they've experienced is a great example of labor management partnership. I was at the Ford plant in Louisville a few months back. Back in 2007, they were down to about 700 employees. They had an existential crisis. They didn't know if they were going to survive. And the UAW and the Ford leadership got together and said, we're all in this together. And they came up with a plan that was shared sacrifice leading to shared prosperity. And you fast forward to today, that plan has 4,400 employees. That doesn't include the supply chain. They're going gangbusters. They manufacture the Ford Escape there. I bought one about a year and a half ago. It's a great car. And what Ford and this partnership highlight is that unions succeed in partnership with business, not at the expense of business. And it's really important. And I meet employers who reject these false choices between taking care of your shareholders or taking care of your workers, but you can't do both. Ford demonstrated that you can take care of your shareholders, you can take care of your workers, and you can take care of your customers by building a really good product. You don't have to have these false choices. And so we do a lot here at the Department of Labor to lift up these stories, and we're going to continue to do that, and we're going to continue to make sure that we do everything in our power so that workers have a voice in the workplace, because that creates win-win situations.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. Yeah, in fact, I was in Portland, Oregon a few weeks ago. I rented a car, and I got a Ford, which I haven't driven in years. I was astonished. It was such a well-made car. Secretary of Labor Tom Perez, the website DOL.gov. And, sir, thank you so much. Secretary Perez, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Pleasure to be with you always.
It's always great talking with you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Just occurred to me I might have been mispronouncing his name. Is it Perez or Perez? Perez. Okay, good. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Robbie in Bronson, Florida. Hey, Robbie, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I want to thank you for your service to our country.
Thank you.
And I also want to ask you a question, sort of a two-part question. You know, the frustration with our situation, our democracy at this point is so great. I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I'm almost reaching the point where I'm not sure that our voting machines are not being hacked. But be that as it may, that we had a wonderful candidate who was a Democrat running against Ted Yoho, and she beat him in his home district around the University of Florida in Gainesville. She beat him, but the Democratic Party only gave her $200 for her campaign, And furthermore, they didn't even endorse her necessarily. They helped her not at all, which makes us...
Wait, I thought Ted Yoho got reelected.
He did. I'm saying she had a shot at beating him, but she had, you know, collected small donations, had about $70,000. He had $770,000.
Right.
But the Democratic Party didn't even give her but $200, and they didn't endorse her, the Democratic Party that she was a part of.
Right. That's a tragedy, Robbie.
That either party, yeah. it doesn't matter anymore. It seems like our votes don't count.
Well,
parties don't matter.
You're, to a certain extent, you're right. I mean, with really, really aggressive reapportionment is the wrong word. What is it when you redistricting? Thank you, Shane. With really aggressive redistricting and gerrymandering, actually, the Republicans have created a House of Representatives that is pretty solidly Republican, you know, or districts that are solidly Republican or solidly Democratic and just not in play. I mean, we're down to maybe 15 or 20 House seats out of 435 that are actually contested between the two parties every other year. And that, you know, it's not a good thing. We need to come up with a new way to draw our congressional districts. And, you know, of course, the Republicans are going to fight that as hard as they can. In fact, here's a shocking statistic. In the last election, the Democrats, if you aggregate all the Democrats in the House and Senate and all the Republicans in the House and Senate, the Democrats in the House of Representatives got 5 million more votes than the Republicans. And the Democrats in the U.S. Senate got 20 million more votes than the Republicans. And yet the Republicans control both the House and the Senate. And the reason why is because of redistricting on the one hand in the House and because of aggressive promotion of the Republican Party in small red states like, you know, Wyoming and Oklahoma and whatnot. Conversion of those states to red to take the Senate. Is very strategic stuff that the Republicans are doing so that as a minority party, they can still govern. And it's not right. It's not good. And I think, you know, the Democratic Party took a big bite out of their backside back in 2008 when Howard Dean was running the show. And as I recall, it was 2008. Maybe it was a little bit before that. And with his, 50 state strategy. And when the Democratic Party lost Howard Dean, they abandoned the 50-state strategy and said we're not going to pour money into races that we know we're going to lose because of the way that the district has been gerrymandered. And I'm very concerned about this, Robbie, as are you. We've got to do something about it. Exactly what we can do about it. California gives us a good suggestion where they came up with a group that would draw congressional districts, at least state congressional districts, using a nonpartisan formula. And it's worked well for California. We need to do it all across the country. Robbie, thanks for the call. We'll be back. So that's before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mark in West Hollywood, California. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, I'm wondering why we don't have a national ID card to promote voting. We already have social security numbers, which are used for many identification purposes. And the powers that be who are trying to restrict voting by making it difficult to get proper identification, I think would be thwarted in this regard if we had national ID cards.
Yeah, the argument against the national ID cards, which made a lot more sense 20 years ago or 30 years ago than it does now, is that we don't want to end up being one of these your papers, please, kind of societies like, the Soviet Union or East Germany or as described in 1984 by George Orwell, that we should still have the ability to be anonymous, that we should all have the right to walk down the street with no ID whatsoever and not be challenged for it or as a consequence of it. And that it should be possible to live your life in a way that doesn't leave a lot of footprints if you choose to. John D. MacDonald in his Travis McGee novels written back in the 70s and 80s writes about this at some length in fiction. And the flip side of this, though, is that here we are now in a digital world with the Internet following all of us, and there's pretty much nobody who you can't track down or learn something about on the internet. And so that privacy concern, first of all, is less of a concern for the millennials and the Gen Xers who are, you know, coming up, and they're going to be the next generation of legislators. And it's also, you know, it's probably arguably a slightly anachronistic concern, as it were. So having a national ID card might actually, you know, be a reasonable idea. And it's something that I think we should all be discussing and debating. But your point is well made, Mark. Very well made. Thanks for calling and making it. Craig in North Richland Hills, you wanted to tell me about the racial profiling bill?
Yes, Tom. I just calling in response to a gentleman that called in earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Did a little look. There was a bill. It's 1038 in racial profiling. But from what I've seen about it, it was introduced in May of 2013. It died in committee. So the Congress, Senate, nobody ever got a chance to really vote on it.
Right.
And so I don't see how this guy was calling in complaining about President Obama not doing it.
Well, I don't think he was. I didn't interpret what he was saying as complaining about President Obama. I think what he was saying is, isn't it ironic or odd that, you know, we've gone so far that we have, you know, an African-American president, and yet we haven't gone so far that we've stopped profiling people based on race. But, you know, yeah, you're right. The bill never got through Congress, and therefore it never got to the president's desk, so he couldn't do anything about it. Although he does have the bully pulpit. If he believes in something strongly, he can push it. And like I said, I need to learn more about this. But, Craig, thank you. Excellent point. Thanks for the call. Morris in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris, what's on your mind today?
Professor, we have another endangered profession. It's called the cartoonist.
Yeah.
We know about the whistleblower. We know about the hackers. We know about your journalists. And so now, if you are a cartoonist, look over your shoulder. My favorite cartoonist of all time was a guy named Conrad that used to do his thing for the L.A. Times when I was in college back in the 70s. This guy was unbelievable. So my heart goes out to those people in France that had that violent experience they just had. But, you know, cartoonists, even though they don't use words, you know, they don't articulate with words or language, their images are very provocative. Very, very provocative. So I just wanted to get that out there. And also, Professor Tom Steyer might be running for senator in the state of California because Sister Boxer is not going to go in 216. That being the case, we might want to make him the father of voters registration instead of Bill Cosby. What do you think? Remember the $50 million. We still need that.
Yeah. I don't know anything about Bill Cosby and voter registration, but I think Tom Steyer is a good guy. I think he made his money as a hedge fund guy. And he put, what, $50 million into political candidates who were concerned about climate change in the last election?
Yes, sir. That is correct.
Yeah, it's substantial.
Anyway, let's keep a heart out for the cartoonists, okay?
Yeah, you got it, Morris. Thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Richard in Lake Villa, Illinois. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I think nobody's pointed out that the president's initiative on community colleges addresses Reagan's problem with education. We're going to cut student loan bills in half, which will let people now get mortgages when they get out of college.
Right. And there are actually, you know, there's a lot of jobs and professions where a two-year degree, an associate degree, can get you in the door. And community college is a great way, you know, it's a great stepping stone into university. So although I think all college should be free, but I, you know, this is a great start. And I think President Obama is, I mean, this is the beginning of the process of taking names and kicking ass with regard to the Republicans by President Obama. I'm just waiting for some Republican to come out and say, what? We can't have that. This is terrible. We can't, you know, and then all the young people in America are going to go, oh, now I get it. So
all of his executive actions have been for the people, and if the Republicans go against it, that all they can do is lose.
I'm with you. Richard, thank you very much for the call. Marcia in San Jose, California. We have one minute before the end of the hour. Marcia.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Since it's Anything Goes Friday, I just wanted to rant about something that has been annoying me for a while. Well, we used to refer to our country as the United States. And I don't know, maybe it was after 9/11 or whatever, but, you know, why do we now generally speak of our country as America? When, if you look on a map, of say a Canadian map, it shows the, you know, Canada, United States, or a Mexican map, Mexico, Estados Unidos. I know that Canadians find that they kind of resent that we have co-opted the name American.
Yeah. I try to use the word United States as often as possible. You're right. And it's not just North America. Across South America, they're Americans too. And, you know, the Americas are both North, Central, and South America. And you know, point taken. Marcia, thank you very much for the call. We'll be back. Stick around. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This is just an interesting little thing I wanted to toss out and see if anybody bites on it. TLC, the television network, has a program, a show, a new reality show that is going to debut on January 11th, the day after tomorrow, I guess Sunday, called My Husband's Not Gay. You might have heard about this or heard about the controversy around it. And it's about men, most of them from Utah, most of them Mormons, presumably, who openly admit that they are attracted to other men. In other words, men who were born gay or bisexual, who have chosen to only, you know, to only have relationships, romantic and sexual relationships with women, and to, in fact, in many cases, marry a woman. And the woman knows that the man is attracted to men, and the man confesses that and then says, but I'm going to stay with women because that's what I want to do, or that's what my church says I should do. And Louise and I have been kicking this around for a week or so. She's quite incensed about this program, particularly because it features a couple of people who are promoting the so-called reparative therapy, or whatever it's called, the ex-gay therapy that is promoted by some of these churches. One of the stars of this TLC show, Pret Dahlgren, has a history of speaking out on behalf of the ex-gay ministries, according to this Carlos Maza's blog over at MediaMatters.org. I'm really ambivalent about this. One of my a dear friend of mine, who has been dead for maybe 10 or 15 years now, he's much older than I was. He was one of my mentors in the advertising industry. And I'm not going to mention his name because he went to his grave in the closet. But just a wonderful man who taught me so much. And he was married, had a son, had a good relationship with his wife. They were good friends. But he was gay. And, I mean, he acknowledged that to me and to several other of us in private. But no way in public was he going to talk about this. And that was just his choice. Now, you could say that, I mean, Bob was his first name. And my friend Bob came of age during the 1940s and 50s. He's about 20 years older than I am. And so you could argue that it was the homophobia of the time that was pushing him to live like that. But there's, so on the one hand, there's part of me that thinks, you know, this television program that is presumably, I don't know if it's glorifying or if it's just showing the challenge of a gay man trying to live like a straight man. That on the one hand, you could say, okay, you know, these guys are making a choice and the women are making a choice and they're fully informed. And you actually have to kind of salute them for being out about the fact that they are attracted to men and they're sticking with women. In other words, they're being honest about it as opposed to, you know, back in the 50s and 60s. And well, even today, you know, some gay men just totally denying their sexuality. On the other hand, is this promoting the idea that gay men should get back in the closet? And Louise is of the latter opinion, and I'm still torn about it. So I'm curious your thoughts on this, particularly if you're gay. I'm curious what your thoughts are on this program, and just this whole thing. I mean, it's almost like I'm wondering if this is the new right wing movement. Is this going to be the new way that the conservatives attack gay people, GLBT people, by saying, well, you know, this guy can choose to live with a woman, why can't you? And you know, the answer would be why? Well, you know, the Mormon Church doesn't. And I mean, that I think frankly that's the answer. That's where it goes. So. Anyway, that said, President Obama is speaking right now. He's saying that the United States is standing with France in this issue with the terrorists, the guys who not only, you know, killed these people, these cartoonists, but they also the ones who ended up in the supermarket. Let's be very clear. This wasn't just a supermarket. It was a kosher supermarket, as in catering to Jewish people. And I don't think that was an accident. And in fact, I think that the press, to the extent that they refer to this just as a supermarket, is minimizing the horror of this. Helen in Ithaca, New York, listening to 1470 AM. Hey, Helen, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. You too.
You know, I just heard within the past hour that they did find these two Looney Tunes.
They killed them.
Yeah, and they killed them, yeah. There were like 90,000. I don't know the details. I didn't know if you wanted to bring it up and if you know more about it.
No, it had just happened when we went on the air. And so just before Bernie came on the air, I said to our audience, you know, there's these two guys and then there's this other man and woman who may be affiliated with them and
the
maybe not.
Still on the loose.
Yeah, the woman is still on the loose. The man is I believe, dead. And then the two guys, the two brothers who shot up the cartoon magazine, the satire magazine, they're dead. And, you know, they're still sorting this stuff out, but three of these terrorists are dead and one's on the loose. And, you know, to what extent she was involved in what was going on or whether they're hanging, you know, I don't think any of us know yet. Everybody's speculating
about it. The 18-year-old kid, is he still in jail or something?
He's in police custody. There is speculation that he may just be one of these people who comes forward and says, hey, I did it, you know, just for whatever mental illness reason. On the other hand, he may have been a useful idiot. This was my theory, and I think I said this on the air yesterday. that this kid might have just been, you know, these two brothers said, hey, you know, we need you to drive the car or something. But when you watch the video, it doesn't look like there's anybody driving the car other than the two guys with their guns.
And they sent out like 90,000 law enforcement to find these people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a major manhunt all across France. But, you know, keep in mind that's a nationwide search. Helen, thanks for the call and thanks for the heads up on this. Rebecca in Everett, Washington. Hey, Rebecca, what's up?
Hey, I just called because I wanted to talk to you about something I don't think people think too much about. And it's along the lines, you know, them wanting to, GOP wanting to cut the Social Security, Medicare, and all that.
Right.
I wonder if people have thought how many grandparents out there are heads of households raising grandchildren.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's
particularly in very poor neighborhoods, that's more frequent.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, well, 2 years ago, I did some research through the Census Bureau, and I was amazed at what I found out. And I just came across some more research that I wanted people to be aware of, and it's by the founder of American Demographics, Peter Francis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a study of the population spending habits and economic impact of grandparents in the United States. I think even big business would be interested in this.
Hmm.
It's a 23-page study, and it breaks it down into, well, he did it in 2009, and he projects clear through 2015,
right.
Which in 2015, he's projecting age 65 to 74, which I fall in, 13.86 million.
Wow. Wow. Thanks for the heads up on that, Rebecca. And I think you're absolutely right. This is an issue that, and thank you for the call, an issue that we're not discussing enough. We'll be back. 50, and the Republicans want to take a bite out of Social Security. What a shame.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's not even a shame. It's a moral and political crime, in my opinion. 15 minutes after the hour. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jane, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jane, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling because I don't know if any of your callers have talked yet about the Penn East pipeline that's proposed to go through my area.
I don't know. I've heard of it, but I'm not. We haven't had much of a conversation about it on the air. Tell us.
I am in major opposition to it. It is proposed to send fracked natural gas, which is already having a devastating effect on my state, sadly, from the Wilkes-Barre area clear down to Trenton. And a lot of it, of course, is, the spiel is, oh, it's going to make us, you know, provide cheap natural gas. But, of course, the vast majority of it is intended for export, like so much natural gas is. And I just want to say, if anybody wants to oppose it, I'm trying to do my part here locally. But if anybody would like to join us in opposing it, the website is stoppenneast.org.
Okay. Say that again, please, Jane.
Of course, it's stoppenneast.org.
Okay, stop. Penn. Go ahead.
Yes, P-E-N-N East.org, all one word.
Okay. Great. We'll have to check this out. Thank you so much, Jane, for the call. And great to hear from you. Thank you. Phoenix in Anaheim, California. Hey, Phoenix. Thanks for watching Free Speech.
Hey, thanks. You know what? I'm just going to make a really quick point. You're talking about, gay families.
Mm-hmm.
I am a gay man who is married to someone who's been married multiple times, and we have 5 kids. And I love his ex-wives, and I love his kids. And he's older than me. You know, he grew up in that kind of era when that's what you're expected to do.
Mm.
But he, you know, we're fine, and his kids love me.
Yeah,
we have grown kids. Yeah.
So you're the family that is the next kind of the transitional generation, the next generation. Your husband grew up in the time when gay men just, you know, kind of, you know, bit the bullet or whatever the metaphor is and married a woman and had kids.
I am, like, his ex-wives are some of my best friends and are his kids. Yeah.
That is great. So, yeah. Phoenix, what do you think of this TV show, this TLC show? Is this going to hurt gay, the whole movement
for
gay rights?
It's really funny when you said that, because I, you know, when I was younger, when I was in my 20s, I'm almost 50 now. In fact, I'll be 50 this year. And when I knew people from Utah, and that was an expected thing to do, that they would marry women and have gay lovers.
Yes, the Larry Craig syndrome sort of thing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, so I'm just saying, you know, whatever, you know, I'm not here to judge anybody.
Yeah.
I'm saying whatever you need to do is what you need to do. But I'm just saying, if you come out and you're honest with your family, you'll be fine.
Yeah, well, that was my take on it, and that this, I thought that the TV show might actually even help the gay rights movement, in as much as these men are openly acknowledging that they're attracted to other men. So they're openly acknowledging that you can be basically born gay. And I thought that's a good thing, although I don't know. Anyhow, we'll continue the conversation. Phoenix, thanks for a note of sanity there and for sharing your experience with us. We'll be right back. Robert in Naples, Florida. Hey, Robert, you had an idea to increase voter turnout?
I sure do. How are you, Tom? How about people love money? How about correlating an election with the lottery, saying that, you know, all 50 states, each state has one winner for $1 million. I guarantee you people will register and people will show up and vote. And the only premise is that you got to spend, if you win the money, you got to spend the money in the state. You can't just leave the country. Another idea is, how about this? How is it that no one's ever showed up to the lottery office with a false ticket? How come the lottery people in the country, you know, why don't they go to them? I mean, the election people in this country go to the lottery people and say, build us a machine so that we could, you know, that we know is foolproof.
Yeah.
You know, like your lottery machines are. And that way I can leave the thing with a ticket and I know that I have a receipt and I know that my vote, God forbid, there's question, I can show up with my ticket and say, wait a minute, let's run this through the machine. Let's see if this one was even counted.
Right. We've got a couple of examples of really solid technology that's very, very highly regulated. One is with regard to gambling. You see, you know, the technology that they use in Las Vegas is amazing. And the other is with banks, you know, the ATMs, automatic teller machines, and things like that. So there's some interesting stuff there. Alex is not on my board. Oh, he's on Skype. Okay, Robert, thank you for the call. Alex Rexroad is on the line with us. He's the executive director of iSave Team, Union for Mechanical Insulation. The website is isaveteam.org. And just an acknowledgement that the iSave Team is one of the sponsors, one of the underwriters for this program. And Alex, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. This is what you guys are doing, I think, is really cool stuff, in as much as you're working to reduce the carbon footprint of America. Tell us about it. What is iSave Team? What are you guys doing?
Well, the iSave Team is a consortium of contractors and installers who, in the U.S. and Canada, who install mechanical insulation. And mechanical insulation, loosely translated, means that it's materials that are placed over mechanical systems that reduce heat gain or heat loss.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, you reduce consumption of energy. And when you do that, you reduce the carbon footprint of whatever the service is, whether it's an oil refinery or your home, frankly.
Right. So Alec, I'm sorry, I was calling you Alex.
That's okay. All my lifetime.
Okay. How did iSaveTeam.org come about?
Well, actually, it came about because we felt the need to market our services in the U.S. and Canada. And we had never done that before. This industry has been around since the late 1800s, and we always just kind of stayed under the radar. Mm-hmm. But we believed it was important to start, and especially with the election of Barack Obama, because the president said we need to worry about energy consumption in this country and footprint, greenhouse gas emissions. And so we decided we should be part of that conversation. In doing that, we started to promote mechanical insulation on Capitol Hill, along with radio stations like yours, along with some other media, print media in particular. And the idea was to get people to start understanding what we do. And we're very small by comparison, but we are very big in terms of savings and greenhouse gas emission reductions.
So
in the 111th Congress, we started to promote mechanical insulation to the Congress. And believe me, nobody knew, very few people knew what we did.
Now, am I correct in assuming when you say mechanical insulation that you're talking about things like, you know, wrapping fiberglass around heating and cooling ducts or putting foam insulation around hot water pipes or cold water pipes for that matter to maintain the integrity of the temperature in those things that are moving heat around in our buildings?
That's exactly right. Not necessarily fiberglass, obviously. There are numerous different materials for different services. Mm-hmm. But fiberglass is one of them, and there are a myriad of other ones. But yes, the end result of that is to, once you do that, once you put that material over that hot pipe, you stop the heat loss or reduce it dramatically. I mean, reduce it to from 0 to 92-93% if you do it properly.
Whoa. Now,
the numbers are huge, Tim.
Yeah, yeah. My best friend lives in New York City, and he had to move out of his apartment this week because the building is 60-some-odd years old, and they are taking out all the asbestos right now that was associated with the hot water pipes that were bringing heat to the radiator in his living room and bedroom. Is that the kind of stuff you guys do too, coming in maybe after the asbestos removal and re-insulating or?
We will do both.
Oh,
we will do the re-insulation, and probably in New York, there's probably somebody, one of our contractors is probably involved in that process. Yeah. May also be involved in the asbestos removal process. I mean, back in the 60s, when I first started in this industry, we were putting on asbestos. And now we found that it's probably not a good idea that we leave it in place, and so we are in the process of removing it in a lot of cases.
Yeah, it can be.
But we do the re-insulation as well.
That's great. Yeah, it's nasty stuff. My father died from mesothelioma. I'm real familiar with that.
Oh, my. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, well.
I am. I wear a bracelet right now that says, "Believe in a cure for meso." That's how important it is to us.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we had him taking turmeric extract, curcumin, and I think it extended his life substantially. But that's a whole other conversation.
That is.
Yeah, we're talking with Alex Rexroth, who is the executive director of the iSave Team, Union for Mechanical Insulation. The website is isaveteam.org. Alec, thanks so much for dropping by, and thanks for the great work that you're doing.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for giving us the opportunity. We really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure and an honor. Great talking to you. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And we'll be back with your calls. A bunch of people want to weigh in on this ex-gay show that's coming up on Sunday. This is a fascinating topic. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Anything Goes Friday. John in Silver Spring, Maryland. Hey, John, you wanted to weigh in on this ex-gay show that TLC, My Husband's Not Gay, is the show that TLC is going to roll out this weekend?
Sure. Tom, it's a pleasure to talk with you. I've been listening for a long time.
Thank you.
And I think you and the other caller just made my point. I think by showing gay people in this light, they're going to prove that, or they're going to show that, being gay is not a choice. It's something that you're innately born with, and that you can choose to act on it, or you can choose not to. You can choose to date women and deny who you really are, which is, in my opinion, a greater conflict than anything, because that just causes all kind of problems.
It seems rather tragic to me.
very tragic. And, you know, I'm not that religious of a person, but I was raised Catholic, and I've got my issues with the church and all that. But you know, there's a lot to be said about living your life the way God intended you to live it. And if we truly believe that gay people are born gay, then I think that was God's plan for you and that you should probably follow through on it. But for certain, the right wing will go crazy and use this as a way to say, hey, see, if these guys can do it, why can't you?
Right. And then we end up with the Larry Craig scenario. And, it, you know, is that good for Larry? Is it good for his wife? Is it good for his family? I can't judge that. I don't know. But it's I see
well,
this as a symptom
choice,
of the
right. I mean, that
go ahead.
It comes down to a choice, and that's the choice he's made.
Well, yeah, and that's, I think you're right. That's the sales pitch that's going to be made with the right wing is, you know, see, these guys could do it. But I have a feeling this is going to help rather than hurt. But, you know, time will tell. We'll see.
I felt the same way. I felt the same way when I heard about it. I was really conflicted. And the more I think about it, the more I think it'll just prove that, you know, if you're gay, you're born that way, and now do what you want with it.
Right, exactly. It's not people don't decide to be attracted to men or to women. There's biology there, you know. And then what you decide to do with that biology, that of course is a choice, but you know, why make a hard choice, a choice that's going to make your life really miserable. John, thank you for the call. Excellent comment. Tim in Whitewater, Wisconsin. Hey, Tim.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I am gay. I used to belong to ex-gay organizations, and I have worked within my own church to encourage the church to be more welcoming to gay people. And I guess what I want to say is the most important thing here is that these people are being honest. I mean, you can't go on a TV show like this and pretend that you're not gay. They're actually saying that they are gay. But at the same time, they're saying they're making a choice. Okay, so they're being honest. That's okay. I'm all right with that. I'm concerned with what's going to happen in the future. How are these guys going to handle it living under this pressure?
Yeah.
I mean, even guys who are married and are open with their wives, they live under a certain amount of pressure. And so what's going to happen? And we're going to see that play out. You know, of course, the TV show is going to go for the dramatic parts. And so at some point in time, we're going to see guys that are cheating on their wives. We're going to see guys that are leaving their families, you know, and we're going to see the results of that as well. So
maybe or maybe not. I mean, it's because with reality TV, most people don't realize reality TV shows are scripted. There are writers who write them. When they cast them, they say, okay, we need an angry person, we need a happy person, we need a fill in the blanks, right? We need all, and they will retake a scene 4, 5, 6, 7 times if somebody's not sufficiently angry or flipped out or whatever. The reality TV has got very little to do with reality anymore.
Well, but there's still drama in the fact that a guy's leaving his family.
Sure, there is. But what, you know, the question is whether they're going to follow up. I mean, I don't know what the agenda or perspective of the people producing the show is, and I don't think we'll know until a few shows in, you know, what the perspective is that they're trying to promote, or if they're just trying to make money and be entertainment, which is probably more likely. But who knows? But that's very interesting. Thank you, Tim, for your perspective and your sharing your story with us. Tracy in Houston, Texas. Hey, Tracy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Great hearing you and listening to your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment. I intend to watch the show, at least first initial episodes. But my feeling on it is that priests, for example, make the choice to not follow their attractions, whether same sex or other sex, and we don't really criticize them for that.
Right.
So I don't see, I see it as the same thing. People can be attracted. We also make choices to be monogamous on large part, but that's a choice we make. And I think whatever the conservative movement tries to do, we have to keep in mind that it's a right to make that choice. And it shouldn't be the government's job to determine that.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. So, you know, so we'll see where this show goes, but your metaphor or analogy or whatever the correct word is with regard to priests, though, I think that a strong case can be made, particularly given all the abuse by priests and whatnot. And I realize, you know, the pedophilia has nothing to do with being gay, but people who go into the clergy, into the Catholic clergy, where you're required to be celibate, really, really struggle with that. And sometimes the consequences of that struggle is really destructive, both to the person
absolutely.
And to the people around them. And that's my concern about these guys who are trying to live a straight life when they're not straight.
Absolutely, I agree. I think it's dangerous, but I think as long as people are upfront about their feelings and they choose to act or not act, and they're upfront about that, I say let them live their lives.
Yeah.
It's when you try to hide things that I think you can really get in trouble.
Yeah, you're echoing my perspective on this, I think you do so as a gay person with more authority than I can. Thank you, Tracy, for the call. Great to hear from you. Rose in Oakland, California. Hey, Rose, thoughts on this show?
Hi, Tom Hartman.
Hello, Rose.
You're going in and out. I'm going to try this. Okay, I basically agree with what you had to say and what everybody else who's called in has to say, except having not seen the show, I'm judging prior to seeing it. But I think that these guys who want to live this lifestyle are basically cowards, and they're not gay. I think that they are bisexual. If you are living with somebody and having relations and having children, and it's the opposite sex, you're living a straight lifestyle,
right?
In my opinion.
Yeah, well, it may be, and there's, you know, for a long time there was this meme, and it's still actually fairly strong out there in the gay community in particular, that there's no such thing as bisexuals. The bisexuals are gay men who are repressed. Actually, we're finding increasingly that there are people who are bisexual, who are equally attracted to men and women, or might have a slight preference for one or the other, but can have just a fine time with either one. And that may be, too. I think mostly, though, they're Mormons who want to stay within their church. They don't want to go to hell. They want to inherit the kingdom of God and the 70 virgins or whatever it is that, you know, comes with being a Mormon. And I guess you get, actually, if you're a male head of household, you get your own planet when you die in the Mormon church. And so, you know, in order to stay in their church, this is what they got to do. They got to shack up with a woman instead of a man. And, you know, it's not my place to judge them, I don't think. Pardon?
Do the women get planets, too?
Yeah, well, that's the point. I think they do get a planet. In order to get a planet, you have to have children. You know, if I'm correctly remembering what little I know about Mormonism, and because your children, your wives or wife and children then populate that planet or become the essential population for it. So, yeah.
Maybe a baby step towards gay Mormons saying, no, we want to be Mormon and we want to be gay.
Right.
And we want to raise our just like everybody else. So yeah. I'm hoping maybe that's a baby step towards that.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, the Mormon church didn't accept people of color. They, you know, African-Americans up until the 78, maybe it was 87. It was relatively recent that the up until that point, the Mormon church's official doctrine was that being black was the mark of Cain. You know, the biblical mark of Cain, where God marked Cain's forehead so everybody would recognize him and throw stones at him for the rest of his life. And it says in the Book of Mormon, that's black people. And therefore, the church did not allow black people to be members of the Mormon church until relatively recently, you know, in the last 20, 30 years. And so maybe this is the next step. I mean, the Mormon church still doesn't recognize gay people. And so maybe this will help with that. I don't know. We'll see. It says here you think these guys are cowards.
I think they're cowards. I think personally they're cowards because they're not strong enough to say. I mean, I had to go against my parents a million years ago and my church and say, no, I really believe in myself and I believe that this is okay. And, you know, it was this me against the world.
Don't you think it takes a lot of courage to maybe courage is the wrong word, determination or something to say, you know, I really feel like I'm gay, but I'm going to live a straight life because I think it's the right thing to do?
No, I don't think it takes courage.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe I'm using that term in the way that Bill Maher used it to describe the 9/11 bombers, which kind of blew up his career at that time at ABC. But Rose, thank you for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anything Goes Friday. And TLC's new show coming up this weekend, which I'm not promoting. They don't advertise. I'm just talking about it. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. You wanted to talk about... thanks for watching Free Speech TV, Norma. You wanted to talk about the EPA?
Thanks for taking me, Dr. Tom. I heard a guy earlier talking about how the EPA doesn't do its job. But most people don't understand that the funding for EPA has been cut year after year for the past 30 years. They also are continuously being restricted in what they can do.
You're right.
And the agricultural bill also did that. They can't. They are restricted on how much they can have an oversight on agricultural runoff. And right now, a lot of people, thank the Lord that New York stopped fracking. The people in Pennsylvania, they don't have water because EPA can't find out what is in the fracking fluid. The same thing is going on in the Gulf now. There are people who are suing the government trying to find out what's in the fracking fluid because of the fracking in the Gulf.
Hmm.
Here in Alabama, we now have fracking. Most people don't think about the South as fracking. They're fracking in Mississippi, not too far from Louisiana's nuclear reactor, which I personally think is stupid. And, the fracking in Georgia will pollute about four major rivers, which are the water source. They're the water source for Georgia and Alabama. And if they continue to frack here, and the EPA can't even check to see what's in the fluid, or where they're fracking, or how it affects the country, you could wind up having the whole South depopulated because there's no water. And that's if we don't even lose a dam from the earthquakes like in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Most people don't understand the EPA cannot even check to see if the nuclear reactors are venting too many rads or anything else.
Right.
And it's the same thing here in Alabama. They're now suing the government over having to put filters on the coal plants by 2030.
Right.
Most people, you just don't understand that EPA has been hobbled and essentially had their throat cut to where they cannot help us or protect us.
It's a good point. And the other thing that most people don't realize is that fracking was invented and promoted by Halliburton.
Right. And that's what the Halliburton loop protects. Cheney's Halliburton loop protects all of these energy companies. And another thing, we do start having the earthquakes, like Oklahoma had, I think, about 3,000 in 2014, and that's from injecting the waste material underground, supposedly past the water table.
Right.
But the EPA has no oversight there either. But if we have earthquakes here in Alabama, the capital is downstream from 10 dams, which were about 100 years old now.
Hmm.
And you have the potential of losing the capital of Alabama. And as this stuff goes down the Chattahoochee,
that's Atlanta's water supply.
Yes. And as this stuff starts moving in the water table and it gets in the watershed and it starts moving south, what will Florida do when it ruins all of the oyster beds, the shrimping, the fishing? And what will Louisiana do when the AMI, I think that's what it's pronounced, A-I-M-E-E, pollutes like Pontchartrain with fracking fluids?
Right.
You have a lot of people who live off of the seafood industry. And then, too, what about tourism when you can't use any of the lakes, the rivers, or the ocean?
Right. Yeah, these are all major considerations. Norma, thank you for calling and making those points, and particularly for pointing out, and I should have done it before, that the EPA has been basically, since the Reagan administration, subject to continuous assault by Republicans in Congress. Thank you very much, Norma, and cutting of their budgets. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. We missed the second hour of the program. She can be with us now, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and free-don.org. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
Well, French police killed three gunmen who rampaged in and out of the French capital this week, ending a three-day spree of violence that left four hostages dead and really shocked the nation and, frankly, the world. They launched simultaneous assaults today on gunmen who were holding hostages at two locations on the outskirts of Paris. And they did appear to operate as a network.
Who were,
there's been a lot of speculation about whether they knew each other. Seems
yeah.
they did.
Who this man and woman?
Yes.
The man was killed. The woman is on at large. Is she still running?
She
around?
She seems to be at large.
Okay.
Yes.
Where did they come from? What's their role in this?
Well, it seems that their role is that Saeed and Sharif Kouachi, the two gunmen in Wednesday's attack on French magazine Charlie Hebdo, one of them, and I believe it's Sharif Kouachi, had been in touch with the man involved in the second hostage situation previously. And had apparently had some kind of contact with him. Hmm. So they had a prior relationship.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, had apparently been in touch the two pieces of the network, if you like, over the past several days and have been monitored by the police.
Right. Okay. Very interesting. What
Very
else is going
interesting.
On?
And there are a lot. Well, and there are a lot of questions.
Yeah.
You know, for the police and for the intelligence services in particular.
Clearly.
Also, on the terrorism front, a Saudi liberal blogger convicted of insulting Islam was brought after Friday prayers in Saudi Arabia to a public square in Jeddah and flogged 50 times before hundreds of spectators. Raif Badawi's feet and hands were shackled, but his face was visible. He remained silent and did not cry out. He was sentenced last May to 10 years in prison and 1,000 lashes. He had criticized Saudi Arabia's powerful clerics on a liberal blog he founded.
Wow. Wow. So and this is the country that's our principal ally in the region. This is nuts.
That's right. And radical Imam Abu Hamza al-Masri, this is the guy with the blind cleric with the hook.
Yeah.
Was sentenced to life in prison today.
Hmm.
8 months after he was convicted of federal terrorism charges in New York. This is one of those interesting situations where you have some people who say that any kind of alleged terrorist should have a military trial.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you will get the kind of convictions and the kind of sentencing that are serious. But here you have Abu Hamza getting life imprisonment. He had been found guilty of providing a satellite phone and advice to Yemeni militants who kidnapped Western tourists in 1998, leading to the deaths of four hostages and for other things as well.
Was he convicted in a civilian court or in a military court?
He was convicted in the civilian court.
Yeah. That seems to be where they get the most convictions. I mean,
well, it is where they get the most convictions.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. There are a lot of issues with military courts.
Yeah. Okay.
House Republicans today unveiled a plan to drastically roll back President Obama's executive actions on immigration and strengthen enforcement of existing immigration laws. Now, this legislation, which would fund the Department of Homeland Security through the fiscal year, would prevent the president from carrying out his recent executive action on immigration and from taking any future such action. It would also undo the protected status that President Obama bestowed in 2012 on the so-called Dreamers, the young people whose parents brought them to the U.S. illegally when they were children.
Hmm.
This plan that Republicans ultimately supported is considered far more expansive than what the Republican leadership team had originally expected to offer.
Is this going to devastate the Republican Party's relationship with the Hispanic community?
I would think so.
Yeah.
I would think so.
Amazing.
It's unlikely to pass the Senate, but you never know.
Yeah. When are they going to go after the president's proposal to offer 2 years of community college to anybody with a 2.5 grade point average coming out of high school? That's
in about 5 minutes, I should think.
I mean, isn't there a certain amount of the Republicans showing their true plumage here?
Well, certainly. I mean, it's interesting because there are some Republicans who support this on a state level. For example, Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee, was in the audience, I believe, today when President Obama announced this and supports the program which President Obama announced, which is based on a Tennessee program.
Right. Huh.
The Georgia has a similar program.
Right.
But he supports doing it state by state and not getting the federal government involved.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Also today, in a victory for supporters of the Keystone XL pipeline, the Nebraska Supreme Court cleared the way for the project's construction through the state, and the verdict eliminates President Obama's chief reason for delaying his decision on the pipeline, because he said lots of times that he'd wait to determine the project's fate until the Nebraska court weighed in. Well, today, Eric Schultz, a White House spokesman, said, regardless of the Nebraska ruling, the House bill still conflicts with longstanding executive branch procedures regarding the authority of the president and prevents the thorough consideration of complex issues that could bear on U.S. national interests. And if presented to the president, he will veto the bill.
Wow. Amazing. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, too.
Thank you. And to you, thank you for being with us these 3 hours. We will be back Monday. And, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. We really all do need to participate. Show up. Tag. You're it. See you Monday.
Been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.